Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories. We have stories that should thrill you a little and chill you a little.
It's amazing.
You will hear adventures sent in by you guys, classic stories from the pulp mags, and episodes from the golden age of radio. We have special segments like Ghost Stories with Sylvia.
That's amazing.
And the paranormal with Jason.
I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
So settle in for the next hour and enjoy the show. Oh, and you just might want to prepare yourself to be taken away from today.
Another 5 Minute Mystery.
This 5 Minute Mystery is being brought to you by the word Encounters. Not only is it the theme for the show today, it's also a tie-in to our story. You see, I encountered this FMM in an internet search this week, and it's brand new to all of us. Never been played before. Let's get to the story.
Inspector Dunn, come in.
Came as soon as I got your phone call. What's up, Lieutenant?
Well, usually Navy intelligence doesn't call in anyone else on case. Now we're dealing with murder.
Mm-hmm.
Does the name A-92 mean anything to you?
A-92? Isn't that the Navy fighter that crashed in the test flight?
That's right, Inspector. We of the Navy tackled the job of seeing what went wrong with the plane. That was no accident. It was sabotage.
Sabotage?
Yes. That means, beside losing a vital aircraft, we also lost a more vital test pilot. Sabotage caused his death, or, to be blunt, murder.
That's where I come in.
Yes, Inspector.
Tell me, Lieutenant, how did the A-92 happen to crash?
Well, the plane was pretty well damaged by the time we reached it. But we did find marked indications that the landing gear had been tampered with.
Wasn't the plane closely guarded before the test?
Yes, it was. And with the exception of the ground crew, only 3 men came in contact with the plane.
Well, who were they?
Well, of course, it was Malloy, the pilot who was killed.
Yeah.
And then there was McGraw, who was another pilot, and Jaeger, who was the chief mechanic.
Hmm. When could I question these two?
Right away, if you want to. I've got them waiting in the next room. I'll call them in here. McGraw, Jaeger, come in, please.
Go, Lieutenant.
Yeah. Boys, this is Inspector Dunn.
How you doing,
Sit down, won't you? McGraw here was to have been the pilot in the test. But he fractured his wrist a few days ago, so Malloy had to take over.
You certainly were lucky, McGraw. You could have been in that crash instead of the other fellow.
Yeah, you said it.
Tell me, Jaeger, what were your duties around the A-92 as chief mechanic?
Well, after the ground crew got finished with the plane, I'd make the final check.
Did you do that the day the A-92 crashed?
Yes, Inspector, and I didn't find anything wrong with it. Can't understand it. That fighter could have been the most powerful thing on wings if it hadn't cracked up. There was nothing the A-92 couldn't do.
She'd have made airplane history. Malloy, he didn't trust any of these new grease monkeys. He always wanted the plane to be given a last okay by Jaeger.
Say, Inspector, would you like the names of the ground crew? There might be a phony among them.
No, Jaeger. I think I've got our saboteur.
What do you mean?
I mean he's in this very room.
Well, don't just sit there, Inspector. Tell us who he is.
Yes.
Certainly, gentlemen. Our combination murderer and saboteur is none other than Chief Mechanic Jaeger.
What clue led the inspector to believe that Jaeger is the guilty one? We'll give you the solution in a moment. But first...
Okay, I know that Jaeger has access and the opportunity to sabotage, but I didn't hear anything that convicted the guy any more than the guy with the broken wrist or the other command crew. If you have to point fingers, it's logical to question Jaeger, but to say he's the guy? I do believe you need some evidence. But hey, that's just me.
Now, back to our story.
What, me a saboteur? Well, my job is to repair planes, not to destroy them.
And your job is also to give the final okay on the A-92.
Yeah, but...
If anything had been done to the plane prior to your inspection, you would have noticed it. But no, there was nothing wrong with the A-92 till you gave it a final check and sabotaged it.
But, Inspector, why would he do a thing like that?
Possibly for money, or maybe a possible grudge. I don't know now, Lieutenant, but I think the boys at headquarters will get that out of him quick enough. Come on, Jaeger, we're going to take a little ride.
Well, that reveal wasn't very revealing. I was hoping for more than just, you were the last guy to touch the plane. I need some motive and maybe some, I don't know, proof? If I were the judge on this one, I would throw the case out. Just saying. This 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by Encounters, which is the theme of this podcast.
Yes, that you said.
Welcome to the podcast. This time we travel to Kentucky for an encounter with a ghost girl in an abandoned air raid bunker. Then we return to the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas, Texas for another encounter with the jilted bride. Why do I say another? Simply because we've heard from this place before. So as an added bonus, I will retell that story from a previous podcast. Do you want more encounters?
Please, sir. I want some more.
How about Robin's experience with Bigfoot on Vancouver Island?
Think I see a pattern forming here.
You should. The theme for the show this time is strange encounters. But we don't stop there. We also have a classic story from the pen of Kurt Vonnegut. It is titled, To BR Ought to Be.
I'm not following you.
It'll make sense. Just keep listening to the podcast. We end the show with a story from World War I about General George Patton.
Who is that?
A really famous guy in history. A few weeks ago, I said that if you asked, I would tell you the podcast download numbers for anywhere in the world that you wanted to know. Lamar Sandoval sent me an email asking for several locations, and I'm happy to oblige. Here are his requests. Angola, which is a province in Africa, had one download. KwaZulu-Natal, which is in southern Africa, had 8 downloads. And finally, Lamar wanted to know his home state of Montana. It had 1,166 downloads in the past 90 days. How about that? Thank you for your request, and I have a question for you. Lamar, did you have a reason for asking for those African locations? I really am curious. Now, let's get to the rest of the podcast with this story from Audible. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, computer, Kindle. Whatever you have, you can listen to Audible on it. So what am I listening to right now? Dragons of Spring Dawning, Dragonlance Chronicles, Book 3 by Tracy Hickman and Margaret Weiss. For the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about this fantastic fantasy series. This week, we review the final chapter of the trilogy. The war against the dragon minions of Queen Takhesis rages on. Armed with the mysterious dragon orbs and the shining silver dragon lance, the companions bring hope to the world. But now, in the dawn of a new day, the dark secrets that have long shadowed the hearts of the friends have come to light. Here is a short clip from the book.
The Dragon Army officer slowly descended the stairs from the second floor of the Salt Breeze Inn. It was past midnight. Most of the inn's patrons had long since gone to bed. The only sound the officer could hear was the crashing of waves of Blood Bay on the rocks below. The officer paused a moment on the landing, casting a quick, sharp glance around the common room that lay spread out below him. It was empty, except for a draconian sprawled across a table, snoring loudly in a drunken stupor. The dragon man's wings shivered with each snort. The wooden table creaked and swayed beneath it. The officer smiled bitterly, then continued down the stairs. He was dressed in the steel dragon scale armor, copied from the real dragon scale armor of the Dragon High Lords. His helm covered his head and face, making it difficult to see his features. All that was visible beneath the shadow cast by the helm was a reddish-brown beard that marked him, racially, as human.
So, who was that bearded creature in the draconian helm? How will the companions bring the war to an end? Betrayal, treachery, frailty, and weakness will nearly destroy all that they have accomplished. The greatest battle they have left to fight is within each of them. Yet in the end, can they still be heroes? The eight are drawn deeper into the shadows, forever changing their lives and shaping the fate of the world. No one expected them to be heroes, least of all them. That is The Dragons of Spring Dawning, and you can have this book today. Here is what Audible has set up for us. Audible is offering a free audiobook and 30 days to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories, and you can get The Dragons of Spring Dawning today. Thank you, Audible. And now, it's time for your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
The theme for our stories this time is paranormal encounters. Of course, this is a wide category, and so the stories could come from just about anywhere. After all, you can encounter a UFO, a ghost, a Bigfoot, or even encounter a time slip. But for today's stories, we will stick with the spiritual side of things and then step into the woods for just a bit. Our first story comes from Daniel Tran, who writes to us from Radcliffe, Kentucky. Daniel is 17 years old and says that this experience happened to him when he was about 12. I have edited this one with his approval, and we have titled it The Encounter at Birdcage Bunker. Here is Dan's story. It was a Saturday afternoon, and my brother Jake and a couple of his friends went to explore an abandoned underground bunker that was said to be haunted. My friend Nick and I were too scared to enter, so we just waited outside. We had brought BB guns with us, so we just messed around shooting bottles and stuff. We heard a series of screams coming from the entrance of the bunker, which is just a spiral staircase going down. We were completely petrified and waited for someone to emerge when I started hearing Jake call my name. I don't know where I got the courage from, but I bolted down there as fast as I could. About halfway down the stairs, I see Jake. He informs me that the group saw something and then scattered. We continued down the stairs to find the others when everything went black. The lantern that Jake was carrying clicked out. I yelled for him, but he didn't answer. I reached around, hoping to find my brother, when I felt a hand. This was not my brother's. It felt cold and clammy. Just then, the light went back on. I was holding a disembodied, decaying hand. It was just floating there, and I couldn't move. Something bound me to my spot and wouldn't let me go. The lantern quickly flashes off and then on again, and the evil thing is gone. I barely had time to process when Jake started sprinting down the rest of the stairs, so I followed. We made it to the bottom and stopped to look around. Before us was a series of complex hallways. Jake called out and started down the far right corridor. I followed. As we went, Jake would kick open every door and yell our friends' names. When we got to one of the bigger rooms, we went inside to check it thoroughly. The lantern turned off again, but this time it felt different. The place was now a tint of dark blue. I looked around and Jake was nowhere in sight. I turned, and there I saw a little girl. I froze instantly. She sprinted, and right as she got to me, everything flashed, and I was back to normal space. My brother was looking around in that room with the lantern on. I told my brother I wanted to leave, but didn't have time to explain to him what was happening to me before he ran off again. I had to follow because he knew the way out and I didn't. We searched for a while longer, and then we heard noise coming from a small bathroom. Jake opened the door and found all of his friends. They laughed and talked about how stupid it was to get lost down there. Then it happened again, a quick flash of black, then dark blue, and everyone was gone. I was still in the bathroom, expecting the worst, when I heard a voice coming from the corner. I screamed and turned, and there she was in the corner of the room. She looked at me and said something unintelligible. I said, "I don't understand." Then she gave the most ear-piercing scream I've ever heard, followed by another flash, and then I'm back. I screamed and ran to my brother, demanding that we leave. It was a rather uneventful walk back to the stairs. With no hesitation, I bolted up those very same stairs and found my buddy Nick waiting. We made it up and out of the bunker. When I got home that day, I started collecting my thoughts. It was as if I was bouncing in and out of a ghostly plane of existence. I tried to figure out what the girl was trying to tell me, but I couldn't make any sense of it. I think her final scream was one of frustration. I just don't know. I've never been back to that bunker, but Jake still goes quite often. He wants to find the answers of what happened to me. That one jumps off the creepy encounter charts. What an incredible tale, and I have to wonder about that little girl. How did she get trapped down there? And what happened to her? I'm pretty sure the answers to those questions are not very good. Thank you for sharing your story, Dan. It truly is amazing. This next story comes from Mark Powers, who lives in Temple, Texas. Hello, Ron. I love the podcast and never miss an episode. I've wanted to share my story for a while now and thought I would last Christmas, but I didn't. Here is my story, and I hope you can use it. I live in Texas, and there's a famous hotel in Dallas called the Adolphus that is said to be haunted by a couple of ghosts. One story goes that the dance hall on the 19th floor caught fire and led to the death of a couple. Because of this event, many consider the 19th floor to be one of the most active areas. When I was 12, my mother, dad, sister, and I went to the hotel just before Christmas Eve to see the famous parade that goes by there. My parents thought it would be a fun little trip to spend the weekend at a fancy hotel and then watch the parade. I was super happy and excited for the parade, and even more so to explore the hotel. I still remember the day perfectly. We had just arrived at the hotel, and I was drawing this little bird in my sketchbook. We walked into the lobby, checked in, and then headed to our room on the 14th floor. It was at this point my mother decided to tell me about the hotel's haunted history. Now, I was a little rascal, and I decided it would be a great idea if I went ghost hunting all by myself. Now, you might assume that that's quite reckless to let a 12-year-old just walk around a big hotel by himself. However, at this point in my life, I was what most would consider way more mature for my age. So my mom trusted me enough to go by myself. It was probably about 8-ish in the evening, and I was walking around the 19th floor. I couldn't shake the feeling that I was being followed. I kept looking over my shoulder, but nobody was there. I soon came to this large window which overlooked one of the busier streets in Dallas. Since it was December, all of the air vents were blasting hot air. These vents near the window were no exception. I looked out for a couple of minutes, and then all of a sudden, the air got freezing cold. An overwhelming feeling that someone was watching me flushed over me. I was terrified. I assumed that I was about to get kidnapped or something like that, so I quickly turned around and looked down the hallway, which leads to a couple of elevators. What I saw, I'll never forget. Standing there was a physical manifestation of a woman in a bridal dress. At the time, I didn't know it, but this woman is often seen on the 19th floor. She was near one of the elevators and was walking straight towards me. She then made a quick left towards the elevator and just disappeared as if she had gotten in. The doors were closed. I was petrified, and in all honesty, I believe that my eyes must have been playing tricks on me. I ran back to the room and told my parents. My mom laughed and said, "Son, you just saw the jilted bride." To this day, I believe in what I saw, and every time I talk about the story, it always feels as if it just happened, and I feel scared all over again. Mark Powers, Temple, Texas. Well, Mark, this is not our first story from that famous hotel, and believe it or not, this is not our first story about the jilted bride. Dana and Derek from Fort Worth, Texas sent in a story that matches up and supports everything that happened to you. Now, normally I would tell you to go find the episode and you can listen to it, but this time I am going to play their story for you right now. It first appeared in episode number 335, which aired on July 5th, 2018. My husband and I love a good ghost story, and we were determined to experience one for ourselves. We are known for going out of our way to stay in places that are supposed to be haunted. We had had absolutely no luck until we weren't trying. Derek and I were in Dallas for a family reunion, and we had decided to stay in one of the better hotels in town, the Adolphus. It is one of the swankiest hotels in Texas, and unknown to us at that time, it's also home to one of the most active hauntings. We booked something special, a luxury suite with its own terrace. It had the most incredible views of Dallas, with plenty of room to move around and to have guests. Our plan was to share it with the family and just have a good time. We did all of that, and we got our one and only ghost story. It was Saturday night, and we were due to check out the next morning. We had been trying to book reservations in the French War Room, and had had no luck. Finally, we got the call that an 11 p.m. dinner time had opened, and it was ours if we wanted it. We surely did, and thought, what a great end to our Dallas trip. We decided to go all out and every bit dressed the part for dinner. We were walking in the hallway to the elevators when it happened. A woman wearing a white wedding dress ran right past us. This in itself was strange because of the hour. The woman seemed distressed, and I remarked to Derek, "Wow, I'll bet she has a story to tell." Derek looked at me blankly and said, "Who has a story to tell?" "Well, that woman that just ran by in the wedding dress," I replied. He just continued to look at me and told me that he hadn't seen any woman. I was sure of what I saw, and I described him to her. His face went white. Then he told me that a steward had told him earlier that day about a bride who was set to wed in one of the hotel's ballrooms back in the 1930s. No one knows all the details except that she had killed herself instead. she is said to roam the halls of the 19th floor where she hung herself, still wearing her wedding gown. Even when she can't be seen, the sound of her sobbing can be heard and is often accompanied by the chiming of a music box. I could not believe what he had told me, but I do believe my eyes. I saw what I saw, and I stand by it. By the way, our room was on the 19th floor. Later that night, after a wonderful dinner, we returned to our room. As we entered, there was a chill that we could not explain. The thermal control said the room was a perfect 78 degrees. We both could see our breath, and that lasted for about 5 minutes. For the rest of the night, everything was calm. When I got home, the first thing I did was to Google the Adolphus Ghost Bride, and it turns out that she isn't alone. The spirit of another woman lingers in the hotel's bistro, and often patrons complain of the sound of footsteps echoing in the halls, even though they're all carpeted. Windows fly open and slam on their own. A phantom piano can be heard playing at night, and many of the guests have reported being touched by unseen hands. Well, there you have it, my story. I want to thank you for your podcast and hope that you read this to your listeners. I think they're going to like it. Dana from Fort Worth, Texas. Wow, that is incredible how well the two stories support each other. With two stories like that, I think it's safe to say that the Adolphus Hotel truly is a haunted place. Thank you for sharing your story, Mark, and thank you for sharing your story, Dana and Derek. Our last story is a unique encounter that Robin Haverslaw had with Bigfoot. Robin and I spoke on the phone, and I wrote her story. She lives in Aberdeen, Washington, and had her adventure when she was 12 years old. When I asked Robin what she would say to people that believe that Bigfoot is a hoax, she simply said, "I just tell them my story." With that, here is Robin's story titled, "The Encounter at Blackberry Bush." I was hiking with my dad in late September on the west coast of Vancouver Island, which is usually when bears are fattening up for hibernation and most likely to be aggressive, so we were on high alert. It had rained constantly, and we'd only seen a single hiker the whole time, and he was traveling in the opposite direction. My dad is really into identifying animal tracks, and the only ones that we had seen so far were a single set of hiking boots coming towards us. All other tracks were washed out or filled with water due to the days and days of constant rain that was doing its best to screw up our vacation. We were approaching a blackberry patch between ridges that hugged a small creek and smelled what we thought was a particularly stinky bear. There were blackberry bushes on both sides of the trail, with only about 4 feet between them. Needless to say, we had our heads on a swivel. There were no overhanging trees, as this particular berry patch was dozens of feet across and 2 or more feet high. My dad told me to hurry through as quickly as we could, and made the comment how smart it was that we were wearing bear bells and how dangerous it is to startle a feeding bear. He was a couple feet ahead of me when I looked down and I saw a footprint. It looked like a bare human foot, except that it was 2 inches wider and at least 2 inches longer than my dad's, and he wears size 14 shoes. It also had dermal ridges and only had a couple raindrops in it, so whatever made it stepped there literally moments before. The scariest thing about it was that there were no other prints whatsoever out of the eastern side of the berry patch. I pointed the print out to my father, who looked down and said, "Hurry the heck up." We were just about out of the blackberries when my dad stopped short and pointed to a clutch of trees down the trail. Hiding amongst them was a tall ape-like creature. It was at least 7 feet tall, covered with black fur, and had a human-shaped face. It just stood there looking at us and then dodged back into the deep forest. A minute later, we heard an animal scream unlike anything I've ever heard before. It rang through the forest like a church bell, and then faded into silence. My dad took out his camera and took a couple pictures of the big footprint, and then he said, in an unusually quiet manner, "Robin, my dear, it's time to go home." We reversed our course and even managed to catch up to the previous hiker that we had passed earlier that day. We made camp near him that night, but neither of us got any real sleep. When we arrived back home, my dad developed the film and made a huge print of Bigfoot's foot. That photo still hangs on his office wall to this day. Robin Haverslaw, Aberdeen, Washington. When I talked with Robin, I asked her if I could get a copy of that photograph. She was happy to send it to me, and I will have a link to it in the show notes. I want to thank Robin for chatting with me and daring to share her encounter with all of us. Well, those are your stories for this time. If you have a story that you want to share, like Robin did, head to the main website at ronsamazingstories.com and click on the story submission banner. And please remember to name your tale and tell me where you're from. Make your story our story. Our featured story for this week comes from the creative mind of Kurt Vonnegut Jr. The story we will hear was suggested by listener Warren Silva. He thought it had a lot to say about our times and where we're heading. I'm not so sure about that, but I will say it's quite unique. It is titled "To Be Or Ought to Be" and was first published in IF magazine in the January 1962 edition. It is expertly read for us by our friend, Bruce Myers.
Everything was perfectly swell. There were no prisons, no slums, no insane asylums, no cripples, no poverty, no wars. All diseases were conquered, so was old age. Death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. The population of the United States was stabilized at 40 million souls. One bright morning in the Chicago Lying-In Hospital, a man named Edward K. Welling, Jr. waited for his wife to give birth. He was the only man waiting. Not many people were born a day anymore. Welling was 56, a mere stripling in a population whose average age was 129. X-rays had revealed that his wife was going to have triplets. The children would be his first. Young Welling was hunched in his chair, his head in his hand. He was so rumpled, so still and colorless, as to be virtually invisible. His camouflage was perfect, since the waiting room had a disorderly and demoralized air, too. Chairs and ashtrays had been moved away from the walls. The floor was paved with spattered dropcloths. The room was being redecorated. It was being redecorated as a memorial to a man who had volunteered to die. A sardonic old man, about 200 years old, sat on a stepladder, painting a mural he did not like. Back in the days when people aged visibly, his age would have been guessed at 35 or so. Aging had touched him that much before the cure for aging was found. The mural he was working on depicted a very neat garden. Men and women in white, doctors and nurses, turned the soil, planted seedlings, sprayed bugs, spread fertilizer. Men and women in purple uniforms pulled up weeds, cut down plants that were old and sickly, raked leaves, carried refuse to trash burners. Never, 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 not even in medieval Holland or old Japan, had a garden been more formal, better tended. Every plant had all the loam, light, water, air, and nourishment it could use. A hospital orderly came down the corridor singing under his breath a popular song. "If you don't like my kisses, honey, here's what I will do. I go see a girl in purple, kiss his sad world toodaloo. If you don't want my lovin', why should I take up all this space? I'll get off this old planet, let numb sweet baby have my place. The orderly looked up at the mural and the muralist. Looks so real, he said. Can practically imagine I'm standing in the middle of it.
What makes you think you're not in it? Said the painter. He gave a satiric smile. It's called the happy garden of life, you know.
That's good old Dr. It, said the orderly. He was referring to one of the male figures in white, whose head was a portrait of Dr. Benjamin Hitz, the hospital's chief obstetrician. Hitz was a blindingly handsome man. Lots of faces still to fill in, said the orderly. He meant that the faces of many of the figures in the mural were still blank. All the blanks were to be filled in with portraits of important people, on either the hospital staff or from the Chicago office of the Federal Bureau of Termination. Must be nice to be able to make pictures that look like something, said the orderly. The painter's face curdled with scorn.
You think I'm proud of this daub? He said. You think this is my idea of what life really looks like?
What's your idea of what life looks like? Said the orderly. The painter gestured at a foul drop cloth.
There's a good picture of it, he said. Frame that. You'll have a picture a damn sight more honest than this one.
You're a gloomy old duck, aren't you? Said the orderly.
Is that a crime? Said the painter.
The orderly shrugged. If you don't like it here, Grandpa, he said, and he finished the thought with the trick telephone number that people who don't want to live anymore were supposed to call. The zero in the telephone number he pronounced ought. The number was, to be our ought to be. It was the telephone number of an institution whose fanciful sobriquets included Automat, Birdland, Cannery, Catbox, Delouser, Easy Go, Goodbye Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre, Sheep Dip, Wearing Blender, Weep No More, and Why Worry? To be or not to be was the telephone number of municipal gas chambers of the Federal Bureau of Termination. The painter thumbed his nose at the orderly. When I decide it's time to go, he said, it won't be at the Sheep Dip.
A do-it-yourselfer, eh? Said the orderly. Messy business, Grandpa. Why don't you have a little consideration for the people who have to clean up after you?
The painter expressed, with an obscenity, his lack of concern for the tribulations of his survivors.
The world could do with a good deal more mess, if you ask me, he said.
The orderly laughed and moved on. Wailing, the waiting father, mumbled something about, without raising his head, then he fell silent again. A coarse, formidable woman strode into the waiting room on spike heels. Her shoes, stockings, trench coat, bag, and overseas cap were all purple. The purple the painter called the color of grapes on Judgment Day. The medallion on her purple musette bag was the seal of the Service Division of the Federal Bureau of Termination, an eagle perched on a turnstile. The woman had a lot of facial hair, an unmistakable mustache, in fact. A curious thing about gas chamber hostesses was that, no matter how lovely and feminine they were when they were recruited, they all sprouted mustaches within 5 years or so.
Is this where I'm supposed to come? She said to the painter.
A lot would depend on what your business was, he said. You aren't about to have a baby, are you?
They told me I was supposed to pose for some picture, she said. My name's Leora Duncan.
She waited.
And you dunk people? He said.
What?
Skip it, he said.
That sure is a beautiful picture, she says. Looks just like heaven or something.
Or something, said the painter.
He took a list of names from his smock pocket. Duncan, 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 he said, scanning the list. Yep, there you are. You're entitled to be immortalized. See your faceless body here you'd like me to stick your head on? I've got a few choice ones left. She studied the mural bleakly.
Gee, she said. They're all the same to me, I don't know anything about art.
Body's a body, eh? He said. Alrighty, as master of fine art, I recommend this body here.
He indicated a faceless figure of a woman who was carrying dried stalks to a trash burner. Well, said Leora Duncan, that's more the disposal people, isn't it? I mean, I'm in service. I don't do any disposing. The painter clapped his hands in mock delight. Well, you say you don't know anything about art, and then you prove in the next breath that you know more about it than I do. Of course, the sheave carrier's wrong for a hostess, a snipper, a pruner. That's more your line. He pointed to a figure in purple who was sawing a dead branch from an apple tree. How about her? He said. You like her at all? Gosh, she said, and she blushed and became humble. Well, that puts me right next to Dr. Hitz. That upsets you, he said. Oh, good gravy, no, she said. It's just such an honor. Oh, you admire him, eh? He said. Who doesn't admire him, she said, worshipping the portrait of Hitz. It was the portrait of a tanned, white-haired, omnipotent Zeus, 240 years old. Who doesn't admire him, she said again. He was responsible for setting up the very first gas chamber in Chicago. Nothing would please me more, said the painter, than to put you next to him for all time. Sawing off a limb. That strikes you as appropriate? Well, that is kind of like what I do, she said. She was demure about what she did. What she did was make people comfortable while she killed them. And while Leora Duncan was posing for her portrait, into the waiting room bounded Dr. Hitz himself. He was 7 feet tall, and he boomed with importance, accomplishments, and the joy of living. "Well, Miss Duncan, Miss Duncan," he said, and he made a joke. "What are you doing here?" he said. "This isn't where the people leave, this is where they come in." "We're going to be in the same picture together," she said shyly. "Good," said Dr. Hitz heartily. "And say, isn't that some picture?" "I sure am honored to be in it with you," she said. "Let me tell you," he said. "I'm honored to be in it with you. Without women like you, this wonderful world we've got wouldn't be possible." He saluted her and moved towards the door that led to the delivery rooms. "Guess what was just born," he said. "I can't," she said. "Triplets, triplets," he said. "Triplets?" she said. She was exclaiming over the legal implications of triplets. The law said that no newborn child could survive unless the parents of the child could find someone who would volunteer to die. Triplets, if they were all to live, called for 3 volunteers. "Well, do the parents have 3 volunteers?" said Leora Duncan. "Last I heard," said Dr. Hitz, "they had 1, and were trying to scrape the other 2 up." "I don't think they made it," she said. "Nobody made 3 appointments with us. Nothing but singles going through today, unless somebody called in after I left. What's the name?" "Welling," said the waiting father, sitting up, red-eyed and frowsy. "Edward K. Welling, Jr. is the name of the happy father-to-be." He raised his right hand, looked at a spot on the wall, gave a hoarsely wrecked chuckle. "Present," he said. "Oh, Dr. Welling," said Dr. Hitz. "I didn't see you." "The invisible man," said Welling. "They just phoned me that your triplets have been born," said Dr. Hitz. "They're all fine. So is the mother. I'm on my way to see them now." "Hooray," said Welling, emptily. "You don't sound very happy," said Dr. Hitz. "What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy?" said Welling. He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity. "All I have to do is pick out which one of the triplets is going to live, and then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan and come back here with a receipt." Dr. Hitz became rather severe with Welling. He towered over him. "You don't believe in population control, Mr. Welling?" he said. "I think it's perfectly keen," said Welling tautly. "Would you like to go back to the good old days when the population of the Earth was 20 billion, about to become 40 billion, then 8 billion, and 160 billion? Do you know what a druplet is, Mr. Welling?" said Dr. Hitz. "Nope," said Welling sulkily. "A druplet, Mr. Welling, is one of the little knobs, one of the little pulpy grains of a blackberry," said Dr. Hitz. "Without population control, human beings would now be packed on the surface of this old planet like druplets of a blackberry. Think of it." Welling continued to stare at the same spot on the wall. In the year 2000, said Dr. Hitz, before scientists stepped in and laid down the law, there wasn't even enough drinking water to go around and nothing to eat but seaweed. And still people insisted on their right to reproduce like jackrabbits. And their right, if possible, to live forever.
I want those kids, said Welling quietly. I want all three of them.
Of course you do, said Dr. Hitz. It's only human.
I don't want my grandfather to die, either, said Welling.
Well, nobody's really happy about taking a close relative to the catbox, said Dr. Hitz gently, sympathetically.
I wish people wouldn't call it that, said Leora Duncan.
What? Said Dr. Hitz.
I wish people wouldn't call it the catbox and things like that, she said. It gives people the wrong impression.
You're absolutely right, said Dr. Hitz. Forgive me. He corrected himself, gave the municipal gas chambers their official title, a title no one ever used in conversation. I should have said Ethical Suicide Studios, he said.
Well, it sounds so much better, said Leona Duncan.
This child of yours, whichever one you decide to keep, Mr. Welling, said Dr. Hitz, he or she is going to live in a happy, roomy, clean, rich planet thanks to population control. In a garden like that mural there, he shook his head. 2 centuries ago, when I was a young man, it was a hell that nobody thought could last another 20 years. Now, centuries of peace and plenty stretch before us as far as the imagination cares to travel, he smiled luminously. The smile faded as he saw that Welling had just drawn a revolver.
Welling shot Dr. Hitz dead.
There's room for one. A great big one, he said.
Then he shot Leora Duncan.
It's only death, he said to her as she fell.
There, room for two. Then he shot himself, making room for all three of his children. Nobody came running. Nobody seemingly heard the shots. The painter sat on the top of a stepladder looking down reflectively on the sorry scene. The painter pondered the mournful puzzle of life, demanding to be born, and once born demanding to be fruitful, to multiply and to live as long as possible, to do all that on a very small planet that would have to last forever. All the answers that the painter could think of were grim, even grimmer, surely, than a catbox, a happy hooligan, an easy go. He thought of war. He thought of plague. He thought of starvation. He knew that he would never paint again. He let his paintbrush fall to the drop claws below, and then he decided he'd had about enough of life and the happy garden of life, too, and he came slowly down from the ladder. He took Welling's pistol, really intending to shoot himself. But he didn't have the nerve. And then he saw the telephone booth in the corner of the room. He went to it and dialed the well-remembered number. 2BR-OT-2B.
Federal Bureau of Termination, said the very warm voice of a hostess.
How soon could I get an appointment? He asked, speaking very carefully.
We could probably fit you in late this afternoon, sir, she said. Might even be earlier if we get a cancellation.
All right, said the painter. Fit me in, if you please. He gave his name, spelling it out.
Thank you, sir, said the hostess. Your city thanks you. Your country thanks you. Your planet thanks you. But the deepest thanks of all is from future generations.
That story was a bit gloomy, I have to say. But do you think that things are really heading that way for the world? I can't believe that it is, but then again, people can get funny ideas about stuff. And if enough folks think a thing is okay, then does that make it morally correct? I guess I'll leave that one up to you. Our story was written by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who was one of the finest writers of our time. He had a writing career spanning over 50 years. Vonnegut published 14 novels, 3 short story collections, 5 plays, and 5 works of fiction. Born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, Vonnegut attended Cornell University but dropped out in 1943 to enlist in the United States Army. As part of his training, he studied mechanical engineering at the Carnegie Institute of Technology. He was then deployed to fight in Europe during World War II and was captured by the Germans during the Battle of the Bulge. He was interned at Dresden Prison and survived the Allied bombing of the city by taking refuge in a meat locker of the slaughterhouse where he was imprisoned. Vonnegut published his first novel, Player Piano, in 1952. The novel was reviewed positively, but was not commercially successful at the time. In the nearly 20 years that followed, Vonnegut published several novels that were highly regarded, two of which, The Sirens of Titan in 1959 and Cat's Cradle in 1963, were nominated for Hugo Awards. Vonnegut's breakthrough was his commercially and critically successful sixth novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. After its release, it went to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list, thrusting Vonnegut into fame. The book was adapted to film in 1972, starring Michael Stax. Vonnegut died of lung cancer in 2007. It's said that on his deathbed, he wanted to sue the tobacco companies for shortening his life.
Not so important times in history.
In this segment, we take a look at historical events that may otherwise go unnoticed. We look at history with a fish-eyed lens, giving a perspective that should provide no insight to anyone or any time. But it is historical, or hysterical, as the case may be. Join us now for this event in history. Sometimes we think that a certain event or place deserves respect, and it is to be honored. Sometimes we are so very wrong. In December of 1917, George S. Patton was stationed in France. The mayor of the French town mistook a mound of dirt for a grave of one of Patton's soldiers. Patton hadn't lost anyone in the fight, but decided not to correct the mayor. Patton wrote about the incident in his memoirs. It happened in the French town of Bourg, where Patton's tank brigade headquarters was located. One day in 1917, the mayor came to Patton, weeping and asking why he hadn't mentioned that a soldier had died. Patton wasn't aware of any casualties amongst his men, so he went with the mayor to visit the grave. It turned out it was a latrine pit that had recently been covered with dirt. The last person to use the pit had made a cross-like sign that said, "Abandon Rear." When Patton realized that the mayor had mistaken a makeshift toilet for the grave of a soldier, he decided not to correct him. In his memoirs, Patton wrote that when he revisited the town 26 years later during World War II, and I quote from his book, "The grave of that national hero, Abandon Rear, was still being maintained by the natives." Now, I did a little research on this story and was able to positively prove that all this really happened. I even found a photo of that latrine and how it looks today. These days, it's more of a tribute to General George Patton, but it's still a sight to behold. I will have that photo in the show notes. Not So Important Times in History was brought to you by GladysGoodies.com. Their products are 100% natural and are a nutrient-rich treat that pets love to eat. You can get these and some really cool swag for your dog and cat at GladysGoodies.com. And don't forget to use our very own promo code, RONS. That's RONS, to get a 20% discount on all of your purchases. That website again is GladysGoodies.com. Okay, we have some extra time today, and I thought I would throw in a few fun commercials from our radio times past. Our first one comes from 1952 and tells you about the good things that will happen when you eat too much.
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those Speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. It was only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
Our second OTR spot is something you just don't hear about anymore. Good old-fashioned hair oil to keep that wavy hair from blowing away.
Get Wild Root Cream Oil, Charlie. It keeps your hair in trim. You see, it's non-alcoholic, Charlie. It's made with pseudolanolin. You better get Wild Root Cream Oil, Charlie. Start using it today. You'll find that you will have a tough time, Charlie. Keeping all those gals away. Hiya, bully. Get a bottle right away. Your druggist has it. A little goes a long, long way. You hear it screaming. Keeps you looking neat all day.
Well, that's it for this time. I hope you like traveling the airwaves of Old Dime Radio. That was episode number 453, and these are the people that made it happen. Lamar Sandoval, Daniel Tran, Mark Powers, Robin Haverslaw, William Silva, and Bruce Myers. Thank you, guys. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find any of the links I mentioned and how to contact us. Do you want to help the show? The best thing you can do is to tell your friends all about it, and please leave reviews or feedback wherever you listen. Clicking that follow or like button makes us grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.